And we welcome you to Bird. We have two interviews for you today. The first, newly recorded, is with the co-authors of a fascinating book about design called Assembling Tomorrow. Part two from the Morning Show Archives features a conversation with the author of a wonderful book called Sizing Up the Universe. Here's part one. In this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, we're going to be talking about the importance of what one might think of as thoughtful design. That is the importance of those who design anything. And all kinds of us actually engage in design all the time in our lives, although we don't really stop to necessarily think about it. But so much of what has been designed, created, invented, whatever term you like, has been done in a way that has created inadvertent harm, and sometimes terrible harm that actually imperils our planet's well-being and human existence. And so the book that we're going to be talking about calls for the possibility of thinking about design in a very different and far more thoughtful way. The book is titled Assembling Tomorrow at the Stanford D School, and has overseen a number of different endeavors. Related and thought-provoking book they have co-created is called Assembling Tomorrow, A Guide to Designing a Thriving Future. Carissa Carter, Scott Dorley, we welcome both of you to the Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having us, Gregory.
Thanks so much.
It's quite an extraordinary book, and to be perfectly honest, I am still taking it in, still digesting it, still exploring it, but it's a book that is exciting, troubling, on both counts. Before we dig into the book and its essence, I think it's important for us to learn a little more about the Stanford D School. Tell us exactly.
And these students come from all different disciplines. Some of them are actual design majors, but others come from business, medicine, law, education, etc. And what they come and learn is how to use design to enrich their careers, unlock their creativity.
Enrich, a term it is, because I think a lot of us amateurs, if you will, from the outside looking in, still kind of assume that what a designer does is designs a new kind of spiral staircase or a new kind of pencil and eraser or something. And clearly from the approach of your book, you believe in that all of us need to think about design much more comprehensively. How would you have us think about the term design?
Design sometime in the 20th century became a profession. Right. And there are a lot of people who are professional designers who have worked on their craft for years. And it's really important that they're able to create things that are going to be mass produced, and they must do it thoughtfully, and they have to do it with some level of skill. But if you think about it, design actually is more designing. We're constantly designing. And what we mean by that is just thoughtfully creating something that's going to go into the world and solve a challenge or take advantage of an opportunity. And so when you look at it from that way, anybody can learn to do that better. In fact, we're constantly learning to do it better throughout our entire lives.
One of the first lines in your book says, "We live in a time of quickening history," which is such a beautiful turn of phrase. And it might not necessarily be a negative thing, I suppose, maybe negative in some ways, maybe exciting in others. But very soon after, we read these words, "Today is an era of runaway design." And that would seem to point to the dark side of this era of quickening history. Tell us more specifically about this term runaway design, what you mean by it, and why that needs to be a term that we're all thinking about.
When we say runaway design, we like to think of it similar to a runaway train. On a runaway train, that train is flying down the tracks. We're not able to pump the brakes. And if that train hits something or crashes, we know it. There's a spill. There's some kind of destruction. Now, the parallel with what's happening right now is that In today's world, we can really all make almost anything. And whether that's like a website, a new policy at work, an algorithm, and we can do it really quickly. So when we launch these new technologies into the world, they take off. They have lives of their own. And when they're flying down a track with no brakes, we often don't know that that's the case until we learn that they've broken something. And when we so that so when we say runaway design, we mean that our technologies are having lives of their own, beyond what we maybe even initially intended with them. And we'd love to call attention to that and talk about our own power in being able to slow it and halt runaway design.
Right. At one point, I mean, and maybe you mean this not entirely in the way you were saying, but in the chapter of your book called Flow, you say one flaw of designers, I think you're probably generalizing, but many designers, one flaw of designers is pretending that faster is always better and quick always equals efficient. I mean, there we're getting kind of specific in terms of the application of what you were talking about. But in some ways, that's really where the tire meets the road, it seems to me, is, I mean, many of the breakthroughs and new technologies and new developments that have been designed, that have been created, seem to have been all about this, to the exclusion of other things that maybe should have had equal weight and equal concern.
One of the maybe the fallacies of this moment in history is that speed and efficiency are equated. And the reality, you just mentioned, Greg, like faster equals better. And we know that that's not necessarily the case. Like if you look at a tortoise, it walks really, really slowly, not because it's trying to, be less efficient. Actually, that's quite efficient for it. It can take in the bugs that it's eating at the right pace. It has a shell to protect it. And they've existed, on the planet. They have really long lifespans, et cetera. Like it is a great example of a species where faster doesn't equal better. But if you look at our technology, since about 2008, if you look at the graphs of US productivity, according to the US Bureau of Labor Statistics, our productivity has pretty much stayed fairly flat since around 2008 as a nation. Now, in that same amount of time, the speed of our processing power has continued to increase exponentially. So we can compute faster and faster and faster than we ever could before, but that is not making us more productive. What is that? What's that gap there? I mean, that's around the time that the iPhone came out, that our change in computing to have these computers in our pockets to be constantly available. So there's this effect that our technologies have created that isn't necessarily one that is making us more productive in the ways that you might imagine.
Right. It sounds like part of what you're talking about is this input into our lives, this flow, again, that we were just using that word, this flow of input into our lives is, at least in some respects, slowing us down. It's too much to process, and we have all kinds of problems moving ahead, working efficiently, staying focused on what matters most when there is just, in a sense, so much stuff in our lives, not stuff in the sense of material objects, but just data, information, sensory input of one kind or another. It's just sometimes, maybe most of the time, too much.
Exactly. It's not just about the power of what in the human capabilities that surround it that have to be taken into account.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with the co-authors of the book Assembling Tomorrow, A Guide to Designing a Thriving Future. Carissa Carter and Scott Dorley are the co-authors of this book, which calls into question the way in which we sometimes think about design. First of all, we sometimes fail to even think about the designing that all of us do in our daily lives. But then beyond that, some of the mistakes that we sometimes make or the pitfalls that are too often a part of how we design our lives and what we fill our lives with. I want to be sure to give you a chance to talk about a sentence that really caught me by surprise, a chapter devoted to feelings and to the connection between feelings and design. And at one point in your book, we read design begins with feelings, and then at another point, design ends with feelings. Explain the connection between feelings and design and why it's really important for us, whoever we are, to understand this connection.
There's some really lovely research at both USC and Stanford around emotions and how they play into decision making. And a lot of the research actually gets into the idea that emotions really motivate us. Emotions are the thing that get us to pay attention to one thing or another. And emotions actually do trigger decisions. So estimate from one of our colleagues named Baba Shiv is that 90 to 95% of your decisions are influenced by your feelings. And so what that means is that the things that we make are spawned by these emotional reactions that we have. You know, we have that sugar craving after kind of a bad interaction. That's a clear example of how feelings lead to decisions. And they lead to designs too. A lot of designs have been spawned by frustration. We go into a story in the book about how mini malls and strip malls came to be. And they were spawned by frustration with not having parking be available, which feels obvious. But when you think about it, the fact that emotions do spawn these reactions in the world then create circumstances that create new reactions. So if you look at the history of the internet, a lot of it is about moving information around. But if you think about your experience online, a lot of it is emotional, right? There, you might read a political message, or there's all these comments that get left on people's tweets that are argumentative and back and forth. And I think the issue there, and it's all intertwined, I will say the last
feelings is when you say something to the effect that just as we pollute rivers and oceans and streams, so we pollute our imagination. What would be the most significant or common ways in which we tend to pollute our imagination and
in a messy way? And so we've polluted the environment over time, and it starts to behave in a messy way. You know, we start to get climate change. We start to get these, you know, polluted fires on rivers. I think you can imagine that we're doing a similar thing for our imagination. The things that we're designing right now don't necessarily look like physical products. They're not cars belching, you know, carbon into the atmosphere. There are a lot of media products. So there are ideas flowing around. There are arguments happening online. Arguments online tend to spread when they're negative a lot more than when they're positive. And so at a certain point, I think our minds can kind of reach a limit, right? Like I can only handle so many articles about something that I'm worried about. And then I start to kind of get so nervous, I start to lose myself. Our environment reached some limits. And I think one of the real sort of conservation activities of the next decade is going to be, how do we preserve our imagination and not get swallowed up by all the stuff that we're creating?
The first part of your book, Assembling Tomorrow, A Guide to Designing a Thriving Future, is devoted to intangibles. The second part of the book, I think you call actionables, and these are, at least to some extent, tangible things that can be done.
Actionables, they're all at the scale of something that you can do as an individual, that you can grasp in your own life, because we do want to underscore that building the future is on all of us. And even in the wake of all of this technology that can often feel like it's happening to us, we do have agency. So those things that are within the actionable section, they have a lot to do with really doing careful noticing of the world around us and to practice shifting our points of view just slightly. We talk about getting strategically disoriented, right? So how do you get, let me just say, let's say you walk home a certain way in the city every single day. You get really used to your surroundings, you make lots of assumptions as to this is how it has to be. But if you take a different route home, you're going to pay more attention to where you are. You're going to notice things you wouldn't have otherwise. You're going to like have a different pace because like the way the stoplights change, you won't be quite as in tune with it, right? You're going to be on heightened alert, right? There's little things like that that help you notice and behave differently. We have ones about laying into awkwardness, like really paying attention to like when you feel out of place, why is that? Noticing how that may, you know, be an opportunity for creating something new. Also, even we call it shape-shifting, where you change your behavior inspired by somebody else or inspired by a different occupation. How would a historian approach this problem? How would a teacher teach the same concept that I'm exploring?
Fascinating. There's a really interesting point in the book early on when we are treated to a bit of what almost feels like science fiction. It is a point in the book when you are taking us decades into the future, and somebody is coming before something called the World Creation Council, which is this interesting panel that is supposed to weigh in on, in effect, designs that have created harm and perhaps figure out reparations and ways in which this particular technology can be somehow plucked from the world and maybe the damage is reversed. And of course, sometimes that's not even possible. But in the course of that really interesting passage in the book, which I found fascinating, these words are uttered. Inventions that took us forward as a civilization might set us back as a planet. And so that's part of the legacy that your book is exploring, is when inventions have been designed that were a step forward in one respect, but turn out also to be a damaging step backward when it comes to the well-being of the planet. That's getting into kind of tangible design, but obviously it's a point you think is important to make.
Yeah, when you think about the Industrial Revolution, we made a ton of progress with our machines and what we could build and create in our factories, etc. And like the incredible amount of pollution that those devices put into our air, right? And now, today, we can see that pollution and we're like, oh my goodness, I can't believe that we didn't consider how that pollution would be affecting the planet. Guaranteed, there are things we are missing now about our technologies that people will look back on, you know, in 100 years and say, how could they not know? And the story that you're talking about is one of, you know, several speculative fiction pieces we have dotted across this book that take us forward and to try on new worlds and to try on moments in these future worlds to see what we think of them and to see if you know, the way that society is playing out in these speculative worlds is something that we want to build towards, or like what are all the other consequences we may need to consider?
Absolutely. And I love a lot of the concepts that you put forward in terms of trying to shift the way we think about design, and in particular, pulling away from this model of runaway design. One of my favorite terms is called deliberate disorientation, which seems like you were kind of touching on this, Chris, a little earlier, I think, but
like they're not staying on course. They're veering off course a little bit so that they can stay on course because the wind will push them back on course when they hit turbulence sometimes. And so how do you help yourself see between the cracks, find the gaps in the things that we've made? And that takes a little bit of work to push yourself back from daily life and look at it a new way. And that can be helpful in raising your kids or in designing a product.
Right. Or coaching your football team or whatever it might
absolutely,
be.
Absolutely.
At one point you say this book is about how we make the things we live with, and how to live with the things we make, large and small. The book again is Assembling Tomorrow, A Guide to Designing a Thriving Future, published by 10 Speed Press, the co-authors Carissa Carter and Scott Dorley. I thank both of you for giving the world this really important book, and I appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Show. I was honored to speak with you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Our honor as well. Thank you.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. I hold in my hands a beautiful book from National Geographic, and in some ways I'm sort of holding the whole universe in my hands, which is quite an interesting experience. The reason is that this book has quite an ambitious scope to it. It's called Sizing Up the Universe, the Cosmos in Perspective, has tried to help us understand the scope of the universe, just how large it is, how large important bodies in the universe are, how far they are apart from each other, and trying to help us grasp all this beyond the mere numbers, which after a while utterly overwhelm us. And so it is a lesson in trying to give us perspective on the immensity of the universe. And along the way, we are also treated to absolutely gorgeous photographs of jaw-dropping beauty. And so I'm so excited for this opportunity to speak with Professor Gott about this book, again called Sizing Up the Universe, The Cosmos in Perspective, which comes to us from National Geographic. Professor Gott, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you.
Looking forward to talking to you very much. I have to say right off the bat, one of the things I especially enjoyed was something you say, I believe, in the book's introduction about how in many cases children are drawn to astronomy the same way they're often drawn to dinosaurs because of the fact that kids love big things and not much is bigger than the universe itself. I guess nothing is.
That's right.
In some ways, what at least feels like a much different science, a much different discipline than the more basic astronomy where we all begin. And I love the fact that your book really in so many ways is content with astronomy in a sense at its most basic, at its most accessible level for as complex and mind-blowing as a lot of this is. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, yes, we start out by showing, you know, how big things look in the sky, how the ancient Greeks figured out, you know, how big the moon was, how big the sun was, how far away the star. And that's to say nothing of, you know, the fact that we have a whole galaxy. We live in a galaxy with 100 billion stars in them. So the distances out there are truly enormous.
Help us understand how we measure distance when we are talking about those kind of distances. I guess I don't mean what kind of numbers do we use, but more how do we...
And you see that star from a different point of view. So against background stars, it shifts slightly. It's just like the 3D vision that you used in Avatar to see the things in the foreground or in the background. So we can see that... the nearby stars, figure out how far away they are, and we found that that they're on the scale that I talked about. If the sun's about 500 feet away, the nearest star would be about 25,000 miles away. That's how we discovered that.
As you discuss some of the more familiar heavenly bodies in the sky, you made a point that I had never really stopped to think about, which is the fact that when we look up in the sky, the sun and the moon appear to be almost exactly the same size. I mean, to our unaided eye, and of course they are vastly dissimilar in their actual size, but almost identical in size and how they appear to us. It just made me realize how confusing that had to be for early man, and it probably led to centuries of a great misunderstanding about the nature of the sun and the moon. That's, I suppose, just sheer coincidence that they appear to be nearly identical in the sky.
That's fairly pretty much sheer coincidence. The size of the oceans would boil, because it'd be like having four suns up in the sky if the sun were twice as big. So if the sun were twice as far away, and only a quarter of a degree, one that really figured out that the sun must be much further away than the moon. The first quarter moon and the last quarter moon, these are the phases of the moon. New moon, first quarter, full moon, last quarter, new moon again. These are separated by 1 week each, and so they're equally spaced around the moon's orbit. And the first quarter moon is when it's half illuminated by the sun. And so he could figure out that if this was the way the moon was being illuminated in its orbit, the sun had to be reasoning. He figured out that the sun was much further away than the moon, and therefore much bigger than the moon. And he could see that the Earth was about three times the size of the moon, because he could see the Earth's shadow on the moon during a total lunar eclipse. So people could have figured this out in the ancient Greek days if they were just tiny bit smarter.
Or a little more open to what... Right, or been a little more open to what on the surface had to seem like a preposterous idea. I want to ask I want to ask you about something that I think is really important for all that we find in this book, and that is taken up early on in what you title "The Shape of the Sky." Take in its full magnificence. Help us understand what we need to do to really grasp the shape of the sky, as you put it.
Well, when you go out at night in dark sight, you can see the sky overhead. It looks like a dome overhead, and the Earth looks flat, and it goes out to the horizon like a plate, and there's a dome overhead. That's a hemisphere. That's half of a sphere. But you can't see the rest of the sky because the Earth blocks your view. So if you imagine putting on a spacesuit, Earth, but just your view of it was blocked before. The sun is still there. It's just down below you. So if the Earth were to disappear, you would be surrounded by a complete sphere of stars. We call this the celestial sphere. And you could see the Milky Way going around in a circle around the sky. We live on a galaxy that looks like a dinner plate. We live in the plate. So if you look out in large distances, you're looking out in the plane of the plate. You see this band of stars, tiny points of light. And this was realized only after Copernicus, but the ancient Greeks could have thought of that as well if they'd just been...
plane. And Khan, as he's flying this other ship around, is only thinking the galaxy as, and the whole universe for that matter, as this immense sphere rather than that flat dinner plate, which is usually how...
structure, and you really have to think in three dimensions to...
sky. There are really only six human beings in history that have had the chance to actually take in the sky all at once.
They just got to look out a little bitty window. But if you actually went out of your capsule, you could see the whole sky, and you would see the Earth over there and the moon over there and the sun over there and then all the stars surrounding you. So it's a view that only a few people have had.
Right. And in a sense, your book is an effort to give all of us that view, or at least help us grasp the notion of what that view might be like. I want you to have the opportunity to talk a moment about some of the beautiful photographs that are in your book that were taken in a surprisingly simple fashion in somebody's backyard. Tell us about where some of these wonderful, especially colorful photographs come from and how accessible these kind of photographs are to anybody who just happens to have the right equipment in their backyard.
Well, a number of the photographs in our book were taken by my co-author, Bob Vanderbilt, who's another professor at Princeton, but he's an amateur astronomer. And when I was a kid, when I was 8 years old, starting to be interested in astronomy was really a backyard hobby. You could go out and see the moon, the planets. You could see the M31 galaxy, Andromeda galaxy. You could see nebulas. But what's happened over the years is light pollution has brightened the sky so that the faint objects like the galaxies and the nebula disappeared from view. But luckily, we've discovered astrophotography. We have CCD cameras now that are very sensitive, very much more sensitive than film. And we have filters so that you can filter from the Hubble Space Telescope. And you can see the Hubble Space Telescope pictures a bit sharper. Bob's has better colors because he's plotting it at the correct colors. The nebula really looks red, and the Hubble picture looks green because they're using a false color system to illustrate various scientific points. So it's amazing that someone from their backyard in New Jersey with a 10-inch diameter telescope can take a picture that would rival the Hubble Space Telescope. And if you want to take a picture of a planet, we now have the digital cameras allow us to take videos where we can take hundreds of pictures of this in a sequence, and then there's software programs that will pick out those moments of great scene where there's a moment of great clarity in the atmosphere and you can see the surface features better. It'll throw the bad pictures away automatically and add up the good pictures to give you really wonderful pictures of the planets. So we have in there a picture of Jupiter where you can see Jupiter's red spot. You can see the cloud layers in Jupiter. Bob has taken wonderful pictures of the planets and the moon. So we're hoping that this book, by showing off some of the beautiful pictures that you can take from your backyard, will encourage kids who love to take pictures with their digital cameras and put them on their computer, might be interested in taking up this as a hobby, because it's really become a backyard hobby once again.
It's very, very good. Spreads also that compare for us, for instance, the difference between Katrina and Jupiter's great red spot, and the difference between the Grand Canyon and some of the features on Mars, and the difference between the United States and one single sunspot, helps us understand how small we are and how immense this universe is. The book, again, is called Sizing Up the Universe. And Dr. Richard Gott, I appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about this beautiful book.
Thank you.
And it's coming up on 9 o'clock.
Wisconsin Today from Wisconsin Public Radio is next. The forecast from the National Weather Service, sunny skies today, cool, a high of 71, a northeast wind at 5 to 10 miles per hour, becoming easterly in the afternoon. Partly cloudy tonight, a low around 61. Then for tomorrow, mostly cloudy and warmer, a high of 82. A pretty good chance of seeing some showers and storms. It'll be breezy with a south wind gusting.